Owen Jones here is a political commentator and a journalist who writes for both The Guardian and The New Statesman. He is the author of two books, Chavs, The Demonisation of the Working Class, and The Establishment and How They Get Away with It. The Establishment is probably a book that I imagine many of you are very familiar with. It's been lauded to the skies, really, and it has so many people have spoken about it. I'm just going to read you one very brief quotation from Philip Pullman, who says, "Owen Jones displays a powerful combination of cool analysis and fiery anger in this dissection of the profoundly and sickeningly corrupt state that is present-day Britain. He is a fine writer, and this is a truly necessary book." The Establishment is also the first ever Blackwell's Book of the Year, and we'll say a little bit more about that towards the end of the evening. Owen is in conversation this evening with Danny Dorling. Professor Danny Dorling is the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography here at the University of Oxford. His work concerns issues of health, employment, education, wealth and poverty, and he is also the author of a number of books, including Population 10 Billion, All That Is Solid, and Injustice. The format of this evening's event is that these two will be in conversation for around 40 minutes or so. We will then throw things open to the floor and you'll have a chance to ask questions as well. So we're very, very proud to have you both here. Please join me in a warm round of applause.
Thank you very much for coming. We'll try and keep it to a little bit less than 40 minutes to give you enough chance to ask Owen your favourite questions. But I get to kick off. So the question, this is a genuine question I wondered. You wrote Chavs. Chavs is a very unusual book. Nobody else has done anything like it. It highlighted something that people were not aware of, which in hindsight, after you wrote it, you see the demonisation of the working class everywhere. You realise that people are treating people in this way everywhere, but it was different and very innovative. Why did you go from that to writing a book about something that many other people have written about, and people may think, oh, I know about the Establishment, I don't need to read another book about the Establishment. So what was the reason for writing it?
Well, firstly, actually, they were kind of, in some ways, people sometimes go, oh, the first book, you've gone from the working class, then you're doing the people at the top, and now you're going to do the middle class bit. But actually, they were both about the Establishment, because the first book was about how the very unequal society in which we live is justified, because the idea, you know, is that we don't have social problems, i.e. collective failings in society, we have individual failings. And if you are at the top of society, you're there because you deserve to be there. You work hard, you're intelligent, you're bright, you're clever. If you're at the bottom of society, you deserve to be there too, because you don't work hard enough, you're stupid, you're work shy, and you're feckless. So it was about how the deeply unequal order that we have is justified, but the second book equally is about, I mean, they're both about the Establishment in that sense. But the reason I wanted to write this book, above all else, was that ever since the crisis in 2008, where this country, like so many other countries, was plunged into economic calamity because of the actions of those at the top of society, the financial elite and their defenders, people's justifiable anger at their problems that they face, both as a cause of that crisis and generally because of the unequal society which you so eloquently yourself describe, has been redirected away from the powerful to people at the bottom of society. You know, and it's the politics of envy, and I find this, you know, it's odd because people like myself, if I say the wealth of the richest 1,000 people has doubled in the last few years from one of the great economic traumas in modern British history, they can afford to pay a bit more tax. They're not going to be out on the streets if they do. That's the politics of envy, isn't it? Because if you stand up for the bottom 70%, they call you a class warrior. You stand up for the top 1%, they call you moderate. But actually, they constantly try and turn people to use the politics of envy to make people struggle, to turn their anger at each other. So if you're low paid, your wage has been cut by your boss, your in-work benefits been cut by the government, you're told not to be angry with your boss or the government, but to envy the unemployed scrounger down the road living in a mansion made out of widescreen television sets. And, you know, if you're a private sector worker, your pension's decimated. A great scandal of our time, actually. You know, not to be angry with your boss, but to envy the public sector worker, the teacher, the nurse, the lecturer. Why should they have a pension when you don't? And if you can't get an affordable home because they're not built, or you can't get a properly paying job because they've been stripped from our economy, not to be angry at the powerful, but to envy the immigrant getting the job or the home that should be yours. You know, you don't be angry at the fact you're being robbed. Be angry at your less deserving neighbours not being robbed as much as you. So the whole point of this book was just to try and redress the balance a bit. That instead of constantly focusing on people's neighbours, that we should start having a debate about the powerful, whether or not you agree about my analysis of the powerful or not.
Okay, I get that. Can I ask you a little bit about yourself then, given you talk about class warriors? Boring but necessary. It's partly the... Well, last week you wrote in a paper that you're no working class hero, and a lot of the comments about the establishments were the who is you. I mean, we have a Prime Minister from Oxford, we have a Chancellor of the Exchequer who did history at Oxford, we have a Home Secretary who did geography at Oxford, we have a Foreign Secretary who did PPE at Oxford, we have a Health Secretary who is at Oxford, we have a Secretary of the Environment who is at Oxford. I can do another
seven. And I went to Oxford as well, yeah. This is what we're coming on to.
And also you might have been the offspring of social workers, so when you...
Was I?
I'm not sure.
I don't think so, no.
Okay, I got that wrong.
Tell me,
where are you from and how do you fit into this establishment?
Well, I was born in lovely Sheffield, where of course a city you're very familiar with, and lived for many years yourself. But I left when I was four and went to Falkirk in Scotland for 2 years, and then I grew up in Stockport, in Greater Manchester. And my dad was a local authority worker. He worked for Sheffield City Council, worked in the regeneration department. And my mum taught IT at Salford University. But they met through... I'm a rightward shift for my parents, because they were Trotskyists. They met through the militant, and they'd be heckling me if this was the 1970s as a right-wing careerist sellout. So, and my dad was the South Yorkshire organiser of the militant tendency. But the whole point about that, you see, was because I was born during the miners' strike. Whenever I go to Sheffield, it's really funny because I do these talks in Sheffield, and I always get an ex-miner who used to babysit me when I was a toddler. Apparently, they taught my older brother swear words, which my parents weren't that happy about, to be honest with you. So I was born during that, but my parents felt very battered by the experience of the 1980s when the left was mercilessly and humiliatingly crushed in this country. And they have four kids, so they just decided to get on with life. So they didn't want me to do politics. But yeah, I mean, and I've said this myself, because I said in that article, I'm no working class hero and never would pretend to be. But the problem with Oxford and Cambridge is that there's not enough people from state schools going to Oxford or Cambridge. I'm never going to apologise from going from a Northern Comprehensive School to Oxford. I want more people from Northern Comprehensive to go to Oxford and Cambridge. And I want more people like the people I grew up with rather than just people like myself. So yes, you know, but I'm not going to end up in this situation. This is the problem I have when people go, oh, you went to Oxford like George Osborne or whoever, or David Cameron, people who went to Eton and other big public schools, is I don't mind people having a pop at me and it just comes with the territory, but I do have a problem with people from comprehensive schools being put off from applying to Oxford and Cambridge, because then they're told you'll just be seen as the equivalent of somebody like David Cameron. I think actually defying the odds and getting into Oxford or Cambridge, you know, because only a small minority come from comprehensive schools who go to Oxford or Cambridge, I think it's something people should be proud of. So yeah, you know, I went to Oxford, not ashamed of that. Want other people from the school I went to come here. But for me, it's not about personal background. This is the point I made in this book. You know, I interviewed the CEO of Ernst & Young. Yeah. And, you know, Ernst & Young facilitate tax avoidance on an industrial scale. And I met the chief, Steve Varley. He's someone who grew up in a terraced house. And he grew up in the north. He's got a stronger northern accent than, you know, what remains my own. You know, plastic sellout northern that I am. And he's a lovely guy, charming, lovely guy. He talks about how he goes home, plays football, all the people he grew up with. But you know what? Ernst & Young, as I've said, facilitate industrial level tax avoidance at a time when our services are being slashed and the welfare state's under attack. So for me, you know, it doesn't matter. I'm not arguing the establishment should be more representative and diverse. It isn't representative and diverse, but I'm arguing, you know, I'm not arguing unaccountable power should be more diverse. Mm. I'm arguing we should get rid of unaccountable power and then have accountable power that is diverse and representative, yeah, of the country. So that's the point I'm making.
But those at the top are arguing that the establishment should be more diverse. That's their defence. It's become more diverse. Mm. So there are 70 people...
In some ways, in other ways not, of course.
okay, we're still
male. It's become, in terms of, I mean, in terms of gender, for example, it's become more representative, although still shockingly unrepresentative, given about 51% of women. I mean, Parliament has less women in as a percentage than Sudan has, and Sudan is not noted as a bastion of feminism. and at the same time, you know, we've got more people from black and minority ethnic backgrounds, though again, not at all representative. Less working class people, though. So, you know, it's, in terms of gender and race, it's become slightly better, though nowhere near good enough. But on other ways, it's become less representative.
I wonder about your the way you do your research in the book. It seems to be two ways. One is you read ferociously. So the footnotes are what, because I'm nerdy, I enjoy the footnotes, and you clearly read a lot. The other thing you do is interview people. And when, I don't know if anybody else noticed it when they read the book, you have an obsession with describing where you interviewed
people. To be fair,
I wasn't the only person who noticed this then.
To be fair about that, actually, I wrote it and my editor came back and said, could you set the scene with the people you interviewed? So I went back and did that at his request. It wasn't my little thing. He just thought it'd be nice to scene set. So that wasn't a... But I don't know. I mean, the thing about interviewing people is, because I hate writing, it's so boring and tedious. Yeah, which is unfortunate, really, isn't it? Because that's my job. But I do like meeting people and talking to them, like you do.
Yeah.
I like chatting to people and meeting people. The problem is, I'm quite easily charmed. So people, my friends have often said this, that I've got to stop meeting right-wing people because I end up so charmed by them. And I end up thinking, oh, they're lovely, though. They're so nice. So I do have that problem. But for me, you know, the point I was making by interviewing people is I wanted to hear their side of this, you know, I wanted to flesh out, you know, in their own words. Because I'm not making a point about individual villains. I mean, that's a really important point. I'm not saying that the problem with British society is there's a few wrong people who are bad at the top, and if we just replace them with a few good people, that's fine. I'm saying the system is the problem. And actually, even if you are well-intentioned and you end up in these positions of power, that, you know, you still end up, at the end of the day, helping to impose a system which is unjust, because it is an unjust society we live. Who would build a society where the wealth of the richest 1,000 people can double, whilst the wages of workers falls for the longest period since Queen Victoria sat on the throne, and hundreds of thousands of our fellow citizens in the sixth biggest economy on earth are driven to food banks to satisfy one of the most basic human needs other than drinking and breathing, eating, 300,000 of them kids. No one would build that society from scratch. It's indefensible. And for me, it's about that system. How is that possible in 2015 that system can be defended? And it's not about the individuals, it's about the systems that allow it to happen.
So how's it going to change?
I mean, I'll be fine in the end.
It'll be fine in the end. You know, we now do have...
Like in the films, the goodies always win.
You never know. You never know it could. We've got the leader of the Labour Party, who famously didn't go to Oxford.
He's the four-time winner of Beard of the Year in Parliament, and they don't just give that award to anyone, because he's a very, very good beard. Mm-hmm. Very good beard. See, people are cheering his beard in the audience.
But that is a fairly seismic shift. We've had a seismic shift in Scotland. The biggest rise of a third party since Sinn Féin got 70 MPs in Ireland, and we know what happened after that.
What did happen?
Incredible things are going on in Britain. What do you see that's most positive, and what's least positive about what's currently happening?
I think what's most positive is, you know, I remember, I think I came to this bookshop not long after I wrote the first book. And actually, at the time, for people like us, it was a bit lonelier. It was actually quite lonely in lots of ways. It was... you know, there wasn't this big grassroots movement on the left of people who were kind of desperately looking for this alternative at all. And actually, in a very short... And we should always look at the good things, which is that there is now, I think, the biggest appetite in terms of people from the grassroots looking for something else that we've had in my lifetime. I'm not 12, I'm 31, so it's a good solid 3 decades there. So, you know, I think that's it, you know, that there's this appetite, there's this enthusiasm that can be tapped into. Look, if Labour can double in size in 3 months, and not just full of people who are grumpily opposed to the Tories and will go out occasionally, some of them, to knock on a few doors on a rainy Sunday because they think, oh, we've got to stop the Tories. People who feel enthusiastic about doing stuff, you know, that is an it would be scandalous if that enthusiasm is gone to waste, that we could build a grassroots community-based movement that can actually mobilise people. That is an incredible thing that needs to be tapped into. So I think that is a good thing. Obviously, the problems facing the Labour leadership are absolutely unbelievably formidable. There's no question about that. And, you know, normally when somebody becomes leader, they have years of preparation and ambition. I mean, half our politicians rehearse their speeches as 12-year-olds in front of their bathroom mirror, which is probably not a good thing, but that preparation, they have a base of support in their parliamentary party, they have experience of being at least a shadow minister, if not a minister, they have a network of sympathetic journalists, they have lots of experience with dealing with the media and high-profile media programmes. None of that applies in the case of Jeremy Corbyn at all. And what happened is he became... You know, I had better odds to be Labour leader than he did, and I'm not even a member of Parliament. You know, it was like an asteroid hitting Earth seemed more likely than him. If you told me 6 and 7 months ago he's going to become leader, you know, I've known him for years, I'd have just thought, I'd have asked which Class A drugs you'd been imbibing. It was just so utterly, unbelievably absurd, the idea. He was 500 to 1. You know, and that was just the kind of like jokey odds. It's kind of like, you know, it's 500 to odds that you'll turn into a giant mushroom, probably. I mean, it just wasn't going to happen. And he was catapulted from obscurity by this grassroots movement that suddenly emerged. The problem is, obviously, if somebody was not prepared to become leader, and we have then one of the most aggressive medias in the Western world and establishments who's going to try and tear you to shreds from the moment you are elected, well, before, obviously, then it's going to be very, very, very difficult indeed. And for them, you know, we can cry, and I can whinge about these albums, but I've written a book doing it, haven't I? But you've got to have a strategy to deal with them. And you've got to have a sophisticated strategy. And if you don't define yourself, they will define you instead. And that will be it will end up where, we laugh, some of us, about the way the Sun, you know, they had a big thing about how far he nodded his head. They claimed he didn't nod his head at the moment. Why am I indulging this? It's so bonkers.
But apart from the media...
But it works.
It works. But, okay, so we've got the media. Apart from the media, what else worries you at the moment?
We have a government which is waging all-out war against the lives and communities, lives of millions of people there. They're going to strip away, slash tax credits for millions of workers who they patronise as hard-working Britons getting up and doing the right thing. 3 million families will be £1,250 worse off in a country where most people in poverty and work earning their poverty. That worries me. The assault on trade union rights in a country where weak trade unions already means that working people, the wealth creators who keep this country ticking day after day, can't defend their
right. But just to stand up for the establishment...
Go on. Well, you're dressed. He's going to the Oxford Union after this. That's why he's dressed like this.
I do apologise.
If you're wondering, he dressed up as a kind of pantomime establishment. He didn't. It's the dress code.
I do. It is terrible. I want to get myself a top hat one day.
I know. So we want a top hat.
So I can do my impression of George Osborne. And if I've got the hat on, it means I'm lying. because it's sometimes when you actually do articulate a right-wing view, it can sound credible. It can sound credible to say we have the most almighty debt now. If we can't balance it 10 years after the crash, when can we? It can sound credible to say, look, we've made these cuts. The world hasn't ended. There is a lot of inefficiency out there, so we can make some more. You know, it is terrible. Schools are, you know, sixth forms have been cut. The amount of money going into schools has been cut. The health service has had a cut in actual terms from what it really needs. But it's not coming to an end. Life expectancy is actually going up faster in this country than in other countries in Europe. Don't say it, but it's actually the immigrants who are very healthy. But still, our life expectancy is going up faster.
We're cheating the immigration.
We're cheating. The world isn't ending. They're a third to a half of the way through the cuts. You know, it's going to be tough, but maybe we need tough medicine to get ourselves into... I should have the top hat on at this point.
You know, I'm convinced. I'm going to join the Conservatives.
Make it slight. And they've learnt lessons. So, at the top of the elite, The Director General of the BBC is paid a fraction of what the Director General was to Director Generals ago. The richest banker, Bob Diamond, we sent him packing. We don't have a banker paid that much anymore. The establishment have learned lessons about their excess. Yes, things were a bit, got out of control 2005, 6, 7. They're buying bottles of champagne. But they've learned now. Oxford University is obsessed by trying to get one more child from Northern Comprehensives. 10, and we would hit that widening participation target and we'd beat Cambridge. We've got Will Hutton in Oxford. We've got the editor of The Guardian who's just arrived. We've got numerous people. So the establishment is changing. The bishops have taken on, and their establishment have taken on the government. The establishment is actually altering in the way it kind of altered before in the 1930s. It's just... you're just so impatient because you're only 31 that you're not noticing that changes.
58, I've had a facelift. there's two things you put there, obviously. You talked about, in terms of the diversity of those with unaccountable power often, and again, I return to my original point there. I want proper representation, but I want a far more democratic country where power is not concentrated in the hands of huge corporations and media moguls and tax dodgers and poverty-paying bosses and financiers, and so that, there's that one issue. So even if if they're a bit more diverse than they were, we're talking from a very low base. In some ways, they're less representative on basis of class. In other ways, they've improved. But it's the unaccountable power that I object to. That's the issue there. In terms of the cuts, the issue you've made there. Well, I mean, where do you begin? In terms of the failure, they said they'd wipe out the deficit in one parliament. They didn't even get through half. They've added more debt than every single Labour government in history put together in the space of 5 years. They've overseen the worst recovery from an economic crash since records began. The longest fall in wages since Queen Victoria, as I said, sat on the throne. A productivity crisis so bad that if French workers took every Friday off, France would still be more productive than we are. Where we have most people in poverty and work earning their poverty. Tax credit cuts about to drive millions of families, working families, deeper into hardship. Kids in colder homes with less hot meals, with parents more stressed about how they're going to pay their bills. The NHS, longest squeeze in its funding since it was founded, on top of cuts to local care budgets, ageing population, and all the rest. 5 million people trapped on social housing waiting lists. 11 million private renters, landlords charging rip-off rents, no security. Home ownership, we're going to go talk about home ownership. Quarter of a million fewer homeowners since the government, the Conservatives, the party of home ownership. So I could go on. I mean, it's an absolute failure on every single measure.
It's a legacy of Tony Blair, isn't it? They're still trying to turn us around. We'll create a Greater Britain. I'll ask just one last question, so please think of some questions. This is my last one. It's a bit of a mean one, because I don't know the answer to it. Every country, of course, has an elite. They're always run by an elite. You don't like this country's elite, and I would agree with you, but where do you think has sorted out its elite the best? You know, where should we be looking at as an example of what it is possible to do, a country where the elite is not just more representative, but actually are democratically elected, they share more, they're less greedy. Where is this utopia?
There's no utopia, clearly, and what we refer... I hate the term neoliberalism because it's such a clunky, technical word, but the whole doctrine of unregulated markets and flogging off public assets and cutting tax on the rich is obviously very dominant at the moment in the world, in the way it wasn't 30 years ago. But obviously, if you go to Scandinavian countries, many Scandinavian countries, like Sweden, for example, or other countries, Nordic countries, Denmark, whatever. They are countries where they have higher taxes on the rich as a general principle, where you have more state intervention, a bigger welfare state, and these are countries with, and they have more democratic participation, more representative when it comes to women and race and all the rest of it, and they have higher living standards than us. They have more growth, which is more equally distributed. They are better functioning, more civilised societies than us. In everywhere. I mean, I went to Sweden, about 6 weeks ago, And, you know, they've got population seven times less than us, and they took in three times more refugees last year. And what's weird about it is they're not all hostile, you know, they're not all... You know, you've got the Swedish Democrats, admittedly, a far-right party with representation. But outside of that, most Swedes are quite proud of it. They're quite proud of the fact they brought in so many Syrians and all the rest. So I think there are better functioning societies in places like Scandinavia, the Nordic countries generally, where you've got a better distribution of wealth and power, more democracy, and where life is better for people. And the idea that that damages economic growth is a nonsense. Mm. And there's other places. I mean, Latin America, many of the governments that have come to power, and these are very poor countries, I'm not, you can't apply what they've done to this country, but they've, you know, you've had huge numbers, tens of millions of people taken out of poverty and extreme poverty since 2000, where you've got, in fact, like Uruguay of all countries, you know, they introduced wage councils, more trade union rights. They've got this massive, you know, the wages have hugely risen there. They have growing, it has a growing economy. They have more public ownership and things work better. So I think there are countries where we can look at which aren't applying the model we are, which is a country, I'm afraid, at the moment, where poverty is going to get worse. Where we're not solving the big problem, you know, we've now got an economic model where we've returned to the old model of debt-fueled economic recovery, which you know better than me is not sustainable. And if there's another global crash, this country is not prepared for it whatsoever. Whilst at the same time, the life of, but if you're in the middle or at the bottom of society, is ever more insecure, ever more precarious, where the next generation, including people in this room, will have a worse lot in life than their parents. And that's not happened for a century, and it doesn't have to be like that.
Yeah. Right. I've had my fair turn of asking questions, and I can get even more. Yeah. I worry about things of... the chance of having a run on the pound. If we're going to spend 18 months discussing how much we hate Europeans, how long is it going to take for some fund managers to realise they can speculate in the pound? Then we have to raise interest rates to defend the pound. Then we might even leave Europe, which is a brilliant way of getting a housing market crash really big. Anyway, you can go on and on about the terrible things that could come. But please, who's got a question for Owen?
If you had the power to unilaterally implement any political policy in this country, what would it be?
Oh, that is a difficult one. That is a difficult one, isn't it? I don't know where I'd start on that one. The housing crisis for me is one of the big issues, particularly facing our generation. I think you're younger than me. I don't know. I'm kind of optimistically trying to shoehorn us into the same generation there. But you know, I think, you know, on housing, what would I do? You know, I'd have a mass council house building program, regulate the private rented sector, introduce a land value tax. I know that's cheating because you said one policy, but I'm just talking about housing policy. I'm shoehorning you all in. Introduce a land value tax instead of our rubbish regressive council tax that we have at the moment. You know, so I think on housing, that's what I'd do. I'd introduce, instead of a £9 minimum wage, a £10 minimum wage by 2020, which would reduce the amount we spend on tax credits without cutting them. So that's, and also, when low-paid workers get money in their pockets, they tend to go out and spend it. Public ownership of rail would be nice, wouldn't it? Instead of, you know, being cheaper to fly halfway across the world than to sometimes than to travel in your own country by train. Where as each franchise expires, you just bring them back under public ownership. Doesn't cost any money. This government believes in nationalisation as long as the French government or the Chinese government running our assets. I think maybe we could run our own assets instead. So there's lots of, God, blimey, where would I go? I'd just go on forever. I mean, so there's lots of policies I'd do there. But one big one. What do you think's worked? Do you think the housing crisis? I think you'd go for the housing crisis, wouldn't you? As the real big...
I'd go for the housing crisis and I'd tackle private landlords.
Yeah, because if you build homes as well, you create jobs and you stimulate the economy. So it does... Housing really is at the centre of so many issues because one in four Londoners live in an over... young Londoners grow up in an overcrowded home, which damages their health and their education. It has a really bad impact on families. It turns communities against each other because people think, I can't get an affordable home, so why is that undeserving person, that immigrant, getting the home I should be getting? So it's good, you know, it puts tensions there. It puts pressures on families. We could also save money because we wouldn't be spending so much money on housing benefit, which subsidises private landlords. So I think housing is the centre of so many ills that I think I would begin with policies there.
Now, we had a question over here.
it's time for all the parties on the left to form some kind of alliance in order to defeat the Tories at the next election.
An alliance between left parties to defeat the next to defeat the Tories. Well, it's complex, that, isn't it? Because the main three, the big three political parties on the left are Labour, the Greens, and the Scottish National Party. I think the SNP, I think that's problematic because their key issue is obviously independence. So that's their focus. They want Scottish independence. So I'm not sure I would have welcomed the Labour minority government backed up by the Scottish National Party at the last election. I know the campaign of fear of a weak Labour government propped up by a party that wants to break up the country made a big impact in England and Wales. There's no, I mean, I spoke to a trade union leader who went to his local trade union branch full of lifelong Labour voting trade unionists. He said, "We can't have the Scots running the country." So unfortunately, that campaign is one of the main reasons the Tories won the last general election. There's no question about that. Of course, I'd like to see alliances like that, but the idea of Scottish Labour and the SNP working together is just not going to happen. With the Greens, the problem is our electoral system. It's first past the post. And, you know, I support proportional representation, like other European countries have. And that what happens then in other European countries is people vote according to their conscience, and then alliances are made between a more, you know, the more moderate social democratic party, a green party often, more radical left parties, and they form a kind of traffic light coalition. That's not possible in this country. You know, UKIP, a party I abhor, they got over 4 million votes. And they got one seat out of 650. That's how our electoral system works. It stops that from happening. So yeah, I'd support alliances, but I don't think it's possible under this system. I think there's ways where parties could stand down in favour of each other. Mm. I know Caroline Lucas, the Green MP, has floated that. I don't know where the Greens vote, to be brutally honest with you, where that would help them. Because there's about three seats maybe that they could then stand candidates in, probably. One in Bristol, where they came in distant second behind Labour. Norwich South, where there's an excellent Labour MP, Clive Lewis, who's...
So the Lib Dems out of the equation, then?
Well, the Lib Dems, I mean, it's difficult, the Lib Dems, isn't it? They're a difficult party to sum up in lots of... I mean, they're now down to 8 MPs anyway. You know, I mean, I think the experience of the last government showed they're not exactly a, you know, when they... They went into government betraying their key policies and everything from tuition fees to VAT to cuts in the first year, and actually propped up one of the most right-wing governments this country has had in post-war Britain. And as a result, they've been annihilated as a political force. I don't know what the future of the Lib Dems are. I don't regard them automatically as a left party. No, I don't. In all honesty, I think they're a very opportunistic party in terms of their leadership. I think that's what their history shows. The Greens... are a more authentically left party, but I just think our electoral system needs to change so people can vote according to their conscience.
There is one in Chester, which is not a poor area. The Green Party didn't put a candidate up deliberately because fracking's an issue. Labour won the seat by 90 votes. So it's happened in one place quietly, because the amount of trouble you get in, I'm not a party member. The minute you might say that another party's even nice, apparently that's naughty. The other one, of course, was Sheffield Hallam, where the Tories quietly walked out to let Clegg... They put a candidate up, but he never turned up to win it. But I'm...
Yeah, I mean, there's difficulty too, isn't it? But I mean, lots of Labour candidates lost in areas where the Green vote was bigger than the amount they lost by.
Because they didn't give the Greens anywhere to go to campaign.
I agree, I mean, fair enough. You know, fair enough, but I'm just saying that and Labour would have lost anyway. I'm not saying they would have won the election if that had happened, but, you know, in Brighton, Kemp Town, which is a neighbouring seat to the one the Greens hold, Nancy Platt, a very left-wing Labour candidate, stood, and she lost by about 1,000 votes, and the Greens got about 3,000. So, you know, that is problematic. I mean, then, it's unfortunate, because I don't want to get a situation where you kind of... Look, the Greens' position is, look, why shouldn't we stand our candidates? This is a democracy.
It's tricky. One thing that we may well get new seats. The next election may be fought on new seats. If it's fought on new seats, you've got to reselect all the MPs, at which point it might become easier to identify... seats. This is a mess, but a man there has been waiting very patiently.
Owen, you were talking a bit earlier in relation to Jeremy Corbyn about how we have such an aggressive media, perhaps the most aggressive in the Western world, and I just wanted to get your take on the future of the BBC, because the BBC seems to me to be being a target for the new government, presumably because they feel it's not sufficiently right-wing and in their control. Where is that going? What's going to happen? How can we defend it?
So the attack on the BBC, for those who didn't hear it, and how do we defend it? Well, the BBC is a, you know, I mean, it's interesting in this country, what are the two institutions, the two kind of big institutions people often most proud of? It's the NHS and it's the BBC. And that's kind of irritating for the Conservatives because they're both institutions which are not run according to profit. And that's kind of embarrassing if you're trying to build a society where your big driving ideology is profit means, you know, achieves the best results. And you know, the BBC is one of the best broadcasters, if not the best in the whole world. So that is, you know, shows the whole dogma they believe in is wrong, which is probably one of the main reasons I think they're attacking it. In terms of BBC, you know, the BBC, you know, I would say the point when you say, you know, because they're being attacked because they're not seen as right-wing enough. There is a problem with I'm not going to defend BBC news coverage. I'm someone who goes and I know the BBC, you know, very well, and the idea of the BBC is some sort of den of leftiness, in my experience, is so way off the mark. It's unbelievable. I mean, you know, the BBC political editor is Nick Robinson. He used to be, came here. He used to be the head of the Young Conservatives. Andrew Neil, their flagship political presenter, I think most would accept he's quite stridently right-wing. He's a very good interviewer, incidentally. I'm not attacking him professionally, but the idea he's on the left is farcical, and he's the chair of the Spectator magazine, a right-wing magazine. Whether it be, you know, David Cameron, George Osborne and Boris Johnson all recruited their heads of communication from the BBC, all of them. And Cardiff University did a study about the BBC's coverage, and they found it was very weighted towards establishment voices. The 6 o'clock news is 19 times more likely to interview a business leader than a trade union leader. During the crash, they just interviewed financial voices as though they're objective, rather than people who should be scrutinised as being responsible for the crisis that happened. They weren't neutral observers. So there's lots of, and actually, what I'm saying is defending the BBC. Because it's not in our interest. If it ends up with the right attacking the BBC for being biased and the left are going on about how great BBC news coverage is, then that kind of helps reinforce the point the right are making. And what the right do is they police the coverage of the right of the BBC, because by constantly going on about, oh, that shows they're being left-wing, that makes the BBC really cautious and try to overcompensate. And I think we need to police them as well, actually. And the reason they think it's left-wing in some ways is because it's socially liberal, I would say, the BBC by instinct. So on issues of gender, race and sexuality. But on economic issues, it's clearly very economically free market. That's what people believe there, from my experience. That's what, you know, in terms, they treat the status quo as neutrality. So I think in terms of the BBC, though, as an institution, it goes far beyond its news coverage. It's a huge organisation. We should be proud of it. Very proud of what it is. And it's an institution people are very proud of in this country, indeed. The Tories would love to privatise it, though they would never say so in public because they know how popular it is. So I think we need to make the case that this is the best broadcaster possibly in the whole world. Huge public love and affection for it. And the last thing we need is a Conservative Party which is shredding it to pieces. But that doesn't mean being, you know, kind of trying to suggest that, you know, we're just uncritical when it comes to BBC news coverage, because I do not think BBC news coverage is fair and objective in the way it should be, because it just isn't.
Yeah. It's funny listening to people from other countries in Europe when they discuss what they think the BBC is like and where it is politically.
What do they say?
It's like an American TV news channel. It's a right-wing news. Just to check, is anybody at the back? Because I'm worried that I'm going to miss you out. No? Okay. You win.
You just said it was the BBC and the NHS could be seen similarly, and I wonder what you thought the current plans for the NHS were, because there's this big conspiracy theory going on that it's being systematically underfunded, ready for total collapse.
They don't hear that, it's just conspiracy theory that the NHS has been deliberately underfunded to prepare the way for total collapse. I don't know about that. I certainly know what's happened to the NHS, and if we just quickly go through that, the longest squeeze in its funding since it was founded, back in the 1940s. Policies of marketisation, of privatisation, of fragmentation, which this government obviously have been aggressively pursuing. Cuts to local care budgets, which puts some extra pressure onto the NHS. And at the on top of that, an ageing population. So the need for the NHS's resources being stretched as well. So all of that together means the NHS is under a huge amount of pressure and is approaching various crises in the future. There's absolutely no question about that whatsoever. I think the Conservatives would love to privatise it, but Nigel Lawson, the Conservative Chancellor of the Exchequer in the 1980s, said the NHS was the closest the English have to a religion. They know that. The idea of just coming out and supporting its privatisation, they can't do that. So they have to be slightly small, subtle and pernicious. The Health and Social Care Act introduced by this government is three times longer than the original legislation that established the National Health Service. It's complicated. And when people like myself and other people maybe in this room try and defend the NHS in terms of what's happening, it often becomes quite a complex technical discussion. And that's how the Conservatives like it. It's very complicated what they've done. Ronald Reagan, I don't quote him often, but I said this to you before, he said, when you're explaining, you're losing. And this is the problem we often face when we're trying to explain what's happening, is when you're kind of going into the technicalities of something, you kind of lost the argument because it's not a simple political argument you can get across. So, it's very dangerous what they're doing. And, we need to make the case. Look, the United States has a privatised healthcare system and they spend about twice as much on their healthcare system because it's so monstrously inefficient. If you fragment it, you have a huge bureaucracy to have to oversee very fragmented services. And in this country, because of privatisation and more private sector involvement and competition, we've had ever more administration and bureaucracy. It's made it less efficient, which is really, really bad. So we need to make that case as well. But the problem is, Andrew Lansley, the former health secretary, when he stood in 2010, the CEO of Care UK, a private health company, gave him £21,000 to fund his private office. Now, that was a pretty wise investment on his part, because they're the kind of companies that are now flourishing. So yes, of course they want to privatise the NHS. They can't overtly say that. They are undermining it. The NHS faces a lot of crises, and it was Nye Bevan who said something along the lines of, the founder of the NHS of course, that the NHS will exist as long as there are folk with a faith to fight for it, and we have to have that faith, because otherwise they will tear it down, and my goodness, how we will be devastated, to say the least, the day we realise we no longer have the NHS that our ancestors fought for at such cost and sacrifice over such a long period of time. It's not for us to allow the NHS to be attacked like this, and we have to defend it. And that's why I defend the young doctors, who've been out there fighting. They're under this huge attack at the moment, and they're not just fighting for themselves, they're fighting for all of us. They're fighting for an NHS run in the interests of all of us, and they're fighting a government that's doing everything to undermine it, whatever their motives are.
One at the back. Yeah.
So you talked about the establishment and the pervasive control that they have over every aspect of society. I wanted to know your thoughts on pockets of resistance, as it were, from working class people, non-white people, women, like creating magazines, media zines, that kind of stuff, to like counteract this, pervasive control of the elite. Like, is there any hope? Is there any point?
Great question. That's not a southern accent, by the way. Is that, where are you from?
I'm from Burma originally, and I lived a few years in Scotland.
Ah, that's fine. I was trying to work it out. Yeah, thank you. Sorry, whenever I hear a vaguely non-southern accent in the south, I would get very excited. I think that's an absolutely, really critical point, which is actually one of the things that is I think, hopeful at the moment, is that because of the rise of the internet and of social media, that there are now, there is a possibility of people who otherwise would be completely marginalised or airbrushed out of existence to be able to organise and exercise their voice. And exercise your voice, that's probably not a word phrase, but you know what I mean? To be able to have their voices heard in a collective way. And that's I think, is very exciting, because a few, even 10, 15 years ago, you had the big newspapers, and that was it. You know, you'd have these alternative magazines, but they'd be very marginalised and fringe, and the amount of resources that would have to go in to sustain them meant they weren't often tenable, because if you don't have lots of adverts and commercial and corporate sponsorship, how would you do it? So now you are having, you know, you do have this growing, you know, alternative media, if you like, and that includes voices, because the media is so unrepresentative. You know, and the government's own study last year showed that over half of the top 100 journalists are privately educated, in a country where only 7% of people go to a private school. Only something like 15% of those journalists went to a comprehensive. 90% of us went to comps, where women are drastically underrepresented, particularly as you go up the media hierarchy, where obviously white voices are absolutely hegemonic within the media. And when I think about anti-Muslim prejudice and Islamophobia, which our media often peddles, if we had more Muslim voices within our media, I think we'd be able to counteract that slightly more effectively. So now I think, you know, and that's because of things like unpaid internships. To get into the media, you're expected to work for free. Now, if you've got, you know, well-off parents, the bank of mum and dad, to look after you, particularly in London, which is one of the most expensive cities on earth, where to get an unpaid internship, you know, you work for months with no guarantee of a job at the end of it, but it's often a precondition to getting any job within the media, where you have to do expensive postgraduate qualifications in journalism just to be able to have any hope of getting in. So, for my opinion, is that has to be bypassed. And I think we're seeing these online, social media, people organising to make their voices heard. The danger with it, and this is the only thing I would make the point, is particularly with social media, there's no more avid use of social media than myself. However, you know, if social media was as effective as we'd like it to be, Labour would have won the last election probably with a 150 seat majority. And the danger always is where we end up in a situation where we're not reaching out to people who don't agree with us. We're just talking to ourselves. We're just, you know, mobilising ourselves. And it's important to mobilise people. And in particular, when you're talking about issues like, you know, when in our sexist, racist and homophobic society, where we're having groups organising and speaking collectively, and collectively self-organising is critical. But we have to be able to reach people out there, the tens of millions of people who aren't reading these alternative news sources, who aren't using social media to talk about politics. And that means community-based grassroots politics, where we organise and reach people who aren't voting. People are voting UKIP, yeah, including working class people who, you know, who have been peddled a politics of fear, and that's partly our failing, because we haven't reached them with a convincing politics of hope. So yeah, let's organise, and the new sources you're talking about are going to be even more important in the years ahead. But we can't end up in a situation where we're in an echo chamber just talking to ourselves. We've got to come up with strategies to organise and reach people out there who aren't listening to us, and we're not even trying to reach at the moment. And that's self-criticism, by the way, because I know I can fall into that trap as well. And I'm always thinking of how I can get beyond that. And I think all of us who want a different society should think that as well.
You need to write for the Telegraph. Okay, I think we're going to do a last question. So if it's a good last question, it's going to be the lady at the front.
Or heckle.
I just wondered what you thought of the irony of the House of Lords turning out to be the champions of the poor over the tax credits.
Yeah, the House of Lords, the irony of being the champion of the poor over the issue of tax credits. Yeah, it's a pretty damning indictment of our democracy, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, look, at the end of the day, you know, they were going on about, I don't support the House of Lords, and I want a representative second chamber where you have checks and balances and all the rest of it, or get rid of the second chamber and have checks and balances like other. Denmark has just one chamber, but they have a, you know, in this country the problem is the danger is you often end up with an elected dictatorship where the executive takes all power and there's very little ways of checking it. So that's the problem in this country. The issue on tax credits is the Conservatives said they were not going to cut tax credits. It's as simple as that. So they can't then go on about the legitimacy of those who are trying to stop them from cutting those tax credits. You know, Michael Gove went on Radio 4 and he said that was going to happen. David Cameron was asked on TV about child tax credits. He said they were not going to fall. So they lied, full stop. So, and they certainly didn't say in the election campaign, yeah, we're going to cut tax credits. On that basis, they have absolutely nothing to complain about whatsoever. it undermines our democracy when politicians introduce policies, regardless of the negatives or positives of those policies, without seeking the consent of the population beforehand. And the reason they didn't go into that election saying we're going to cut tax credits is they knew they were likely not to have won enough votes to form a government. And that's why the whole thing means they won on that basis on a false pretense. And did you see on Question Time, the woman who berated the Conservatives, and she her tax credits have been cut, and she voted Conservative, and now he's become Jeremy Corbyn's biggest fan. So it shows, just because you voted Tory in May doesn't mean those people should be written off. We should reach as many people as we can. But she's a self-employed woman, because a million self-employed people are about to have their tax credits cut, and these are the people portrayed as the entrepreneurial strivers who the Conservatives say they admire so much, but they're being attacked. So the tax credits issue is an absolutely fundamental point. And the House of Lords, the reason they could make the case they did is because the Conservatives did not put that in their manifesto, and indeed denied they were going to do it. And I would just say this, this is an absolutely critical issue, and families next month are going to get letters landing on their mats telling them before Christmas about how much money they're going to have cut. But I think we've got them on the run on this. They've rattled. George Osborne was supposed to be this masterful strategist, but he's caused an absolute mess. And the Conservatives are trying to portray themselves, relaunch themselves as the party of working people. That is the sound of satire being bludgeoned to death. But this is an issue. We really have to go on this and hammer them on this, because this is an issue which is about making working people, the people who keep this country ticking, worse off, driving their kids into poverty and hardship and insecurity. And by all means possible, we have to try and fight them on this. And we can win. I genuinely think we can put them on the back foot. And if we can put them on the back foot on this, then we can put them on the back foot on all these other issues as well. And let's not forget to wrap this up. The Conservatives are not almighty. We act as though they won a landslide, as though they got 150 seats. They didn't. They got 12, a majority of 12. And they won the lowest share of the vote that any majority Conservative government has ever had. They are a lot weaker than they often appear, just because they have the whole press cheering them on. They only won, as we were talking about before, a quarter of eligible voters voted for them. So let's remember that. They're weak. That if we build a strong enough movement with an alternative that resonates with people, then we can defeat them and we can build a different sort of society. But it's up to every single person in this room that if you want to change society, we all have to do our bit. We all have to get organised somehow. Our ancestors did it, and they, at great cost and sacrifice, won many of the rights and freedoms that are now under attack today. And it's our responsibility in that tradition to defend those rights and freedoms and to keep fighting until we build a different sort of society.
Thank you, Owen. Thank you for such a great set of questions. The real reason I'm wearing the posh jacket tonight isn't that I'm talking in the Oxford Union. It's because I have something far more pleasurable to do. It's with great pleasure and a little bit of envy that I get to pass over the Blackwell's Book of the Year award to Owen. This is the heaviest.
So heavy. Right. So that sounds really great. How dare they give me a...
Please do come later on and just feel this. This is the heaviest and nicest looking award I have ever seen.
Can I just say a very quick word about this award, just to give you a very quick explanation. So the voting pool for this award was several hundred booksellers across the United Kingdom in 50 different bookshops, from Aberdeen to Exeter, as we like to say. So booksellers in Newcastle, Leeds, Nottingham, Sheffield, Bristol, Cambridge, Edinburgh, Oxford itself, and 40 other towns and cities across the country. It's the first time there's ever been a Blackwell's Book of the Year award. There was a short list of 12 books, including fiction and non-fiction titles. Booksellers voted in their droves, and we're very, very proud. And thank you, Danny, for this, to hand this award to Owen Jones.
Yeah, thank you.
That's okay. And what it means is you've got to write another book.